We have some more exciting news regarding our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. Rue Morgue magazine recently said this about the book. What separates Death by Umbrella from your run-of-the-mill glossary is the amount of heart and appreciation within its pages, recommended for gore hounds, list lovers, and trivia fiends. Well, we hope you're one of those and that you pick up the book. It's available at Amazon. Thanks a lot.
News this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
What went we out into this wilderness to find? Leaving our country, kindred, our fathers' houses.
Toronto headquarters, here's episode 142, The Witch. Now, there are some films that are given the appellation critic proof, which means basically whatever anyone says about it, people will flock to the multiplexes, it really doesn't matter. And then I would say there's also another type of film which are ready-made for critics, and this one almost seems to be that. And it, excuse the pun, audience be damned here, but this one seemed to have a higher purpose in mind, and this has really shown like a cleavage between like what the critics say and what the audience says, because, my God, there's a pretty big gulf between the two, and I did a little research online, and whoa, audiences not into this. Critics overwhelmingly into this, so where do we fall?
Well, I guess call me a critic, because I'm way into this. This was a film that was released last year, subtitled A New England Folktale. This was the directorial debut from Robert Eggers. He also wrote it. And when this thing came out, similar to The Babadook. I mean, it came out to a tsunami of hype. This was the second coming. This was, or the third coming, or the fourth coming. This was it. This was the horror movie the fans of the genre had been waiting for. And the reviews were exemplary. And then when it opened in packed houses. Everybody was looking for something. But what were they looking for? Because a lot of people were disappointed. And it's amazing. It almost gave me whiplash because I didn't see it in the theaters. This was my second viewing for the podcast. My first viewing was on Blu-ray. But I recall it being in the theaters. And an opening weekend, everybody loved The Witch. I'm going to go see The Witch. I can't wait to see The Witch. And then the second weekend, The Witch sucks. The Witch is the worst movie ever. And by the third weekend, it was pretty much like done. People were moving on to something else. And yeah, to this day, you still have people saying, The Witch sucks. The Babadook sucks. What have you. Well, I happen to think that The Witch and The Babadook are two of the best horror movies, definitely this decade. But this was your first viewing, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always reticent about watching these movies that have so many reviews up on IMDb, because generally it's a bad sign. Anything that crosses the cultural boundary to be accepted by mainstream critics, I always like, that's a little weird. Like they always love these so-called smart films like It Follows and all these indie darlings, but then they'll turn their noses up at some of the stuff that we grew up loving. So I'm a little weirded out by anything with like 300 and 400 critical reviews on there, because they generally shun horror movies.
Well, it's weird because a lot of the things that the critics loved were things that this movie didn't have, and those were things that audiences were expecting, i.e. jump scares. There was no one jump scare in this movie.
The little baby Samuel disappearing.
That was
the
not a jump scare. That was a legitimate scare.
Hmm. Either way, it was set up like a jump scare. That was maybe the only one, and that's borderline.
There was no crescendo music, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just a cat. No.
For sure.
There was, there was gore, but it was minimal, and it was highly disturbing as far as I was concerned. And the other thing that this film didn't have was central casting archetypes. And then the other thing that people complained about, and this complaint to me is completely baseless. I couldn't understand the dialogue. I couldn't understand what they were saying. If anybody's ever seen a Shakespearean play would have no difficulty understanding what they were saying. There was never a point where, and they weren't even speaking Shakespearean. They were speaking just old English. There was never a point where I had to strain to figure out what they were saying. Sure, there was a lot of yees and thous and theys and those and thines, but no, that was baseless criticism.
Yeah, some of it was just the people who saw it in the theater, and I think it was not so much the accent, but the low register that the father spoke in, plus the fact that he's like Yorkshire, so he's got this low thing and it reverberated. But once you picked up on it, it was a minor thing. Just had to get used to it, and then
opening weekend audiences, they're so conditioned by the Blumhouse model. They want to go in there. They want the jump scares. They want what was that? You know, did you see it in the corner? Oh my god! And they want to go on a date. They want to have that scare where they go, and then they put their arm around their girlfriend and hug them, and it's all good. They want that final bump at the end. Hmm. You know, I hate that bump. Just when you think everything's all good, boom, there's the ghost right in your face.
Yeah, true.
I hate that model. I despise it, and it's conditioned audiences. So this, when something intelligent like this comes out, something artful, something so well-crafted, audiences should have been embracing this thing in droves. It was profitable. It was front-loaded. That money was made in the opening weekend. Then word of mouth made the movie plummet, and this movie should have been embraced by the mainstream community. But you know what? I'm just going to say maybe I'm an elitist. I don't know, but I embrace it because this to me was wonderful.
I gave it a second shot because I got a little bit of PBS,
Masterpiece,
a little bit of like what you'd be spoon-fed to enjoy history with in school. That kind of a little bit kind of clunky. But by the same token, on second viewing, I got a little bit more into it because I began to appreciate just how ballsy it was to make a movie that is almost doomed to failure in a way. Like, you couldn't pick in history a duller group of people to center a movie around, really. Like, apart from the Salem witch trials, Puritans, like, there's a reason puritanical is a pejorative. Like, it's people who have no fun, they don't drink, they don't dance, they don't enjoy poetry, they don't enjoy music, they're all about God. Like, that's fairly dull stuff. And to set this in the wilderness with a family of, like, bonnet-wearing buckleheads, it's like, holy crap, like, that is amazing to me to do this. That balls to the wall for that.
And like, thematically, that's what made the movie wonderful, because when you look at this movie, I mean, you could look at it many different levels, right? You could look at it almost like a retelling of the story of Job. I mean, they make a reference to it at one point. The wife says, I feel like the wife of Job. You can look at it as hubris and pride leading to someone's eventual downfall. But really, this is an epic struggle between God and the devil, okay? Centered around one family where the father, William, put all his faith in his comprehension of God, and that's why he was banished. We'll talk about that when we start getting to the plot.
Yeah, he was too pure for the Puritans.
And because of that, there's a song by Tom Waits where it's called God's Away on Business. And that's it. God was away on business. And this family was beset by evil from the moment they set foot on the shores of America. And it's absolutely terrifying, because this is a world where God exists, yet it's a godless world, because he has turned his back on these Puritans, on this family. There are many questions you can ask. Well, why did they deserve this? What was the catalyst for these calamities, one after another after another? Was it the father? Was it his pride? Was it Thomasin and some of the stuff that she did, some of her desires and sins? Or was it just random? Whatever. But the reality of the matter is that's terrifying, dude. I mean,
yeah, everyone's in or fallible, right? Like, even the most perfect, God-fearing man, even the best and held up on a pedestal as the shining exemplar among us, he was completely flawed and lying on behalf of his daughter. Everyone in that family was, well, the girl Thomasin, she actually divulges a bunch of her sins, and there's a laundry list that she is forsaking the Lord on the Sabbath day.
Yeah, some of them aren't.
Well, I mean, it's venial sins versus major sins.
Basically,
she's a sinner. They're all sinners.
But don't forget, I mean, as far as the puritanicals are concerned,
they're
sinners from the very beginning. They're
as far as Christianity is concerned,
everything that they do is sinful.
Mm-hmm.
I whistled a happy tune. I sinned. You know what I mean? Like, it's.
Yeah.
But anyway, as I said before, this film is thematically rich. I'd love to get into it some more, but let's do a brief synopsis of the plot for them.
Yeah.
So we start off, and it's the perspective of the kids. And this is a family. It's a wife, Catherine, a father, William, and they had five kids? Thomasin, the twins.
Yeah, Caleb, Mercy,
Jonas.
And Samuel. Yeah.
So they had five kids, and they're watching their father in some sort of tribunal. And he did something. We don't know what he did, but he did something to offend this highly religious community.
Yeah, which probably didn't take much. And this reminded me, as an aside, I was in a high school production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which was set at this exact time, the Salem witch trials, the Puritans. I played a judge because I couldn't act, so the drama teacher put me in the role of judge, and I basically yelled at people that I was a Puritan judge. I yelled at people that I saw them with the devil. And all I did was accuse and point my finger. I saw Abigail with the devil. I saw Jebediah with the devil. I saw Abby with the devil. And that was my entire role. And so
How old were you when you...
I was not Sir Laurence Olivier there. I was just yelling, like, hamming it up.
How old were you?
I was awful. 16, 17.
Oh, what I wouldn't...
I know. What you would have given to see me in a black smock and a robe and, like, yelling with a gavel.
Those ridiculous things,
too?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It was bad.
Because I didn't meet you until you came to our high school. Yeah. And, like, I think, like, grade 12 and you're, like, 17. Oh, my Lord. I would have paid good money to see that. But anyway, let's get back.
I would have been the guy who banished William and family from this Massachusetts enclave.
The reality is, he could have repented. He could have asked for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. He could have asked for penance, what have you. He did not.
Yeah.
And thus, he was banished. Thus spoke the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And when we next see the family, there's a
cut. And the door closes on them. That was just great. From the town, just boom. Mm-hmm. And then they're in there like...
Wagon,
and all their belongings are being dragged into the woods, and that was a neat scene, and just a real closure, and that you just feel they are isolated in the woods. There's nothing more they can do. They're left to their own devices.
And then we see them in their new settlement. They've obviously been there for a year or two. Everything's already going to shit. The crops are blighted and rotted. The food is scarce. Things aren't going well. The father is not a good hunter, gatherer, nor farmer. But he is a good God-fearing man, or so he thinks.
Yeah, and they have provisions, so they think they should be able to last. They've got goats, they've got a horse, they've got, you know, musket, they've got all the provisions that should see them succeed. But, as you said, things are not going well from this family from banishment onward. Mm-hmm. And we get a little sense of that right off the bat, of their inability to fend for themselves.
We see Thomason, and you mentioned this earlier, praying and confessing, and because they're so, I guess, puritanical, you know, she's saying, God, I've committed all these sins, I deserve punishment. She's asking for punishment. She's asking to burn in hellfire because of how, quote-unquote, sinful she is. And as this movie progresses, you have to ask yourself, did she get what she asked for? Did she get what she deserves? That's a mild spoiler for the ending. Mm-hmm. Another thing you have to ask yourself is, for all the calamities that befall this family, and it's not just the father, it's also, you know, Caleb, the brother, Thomason, everybody, did they get what they deserved? Because this is biblical-style punishment. Did the pride, did the hubris, did the piousness in the face of religion, and this is how we're supposed to be versus how we're not supposed to be, did that justify the fate that befell this family? And in many ways, the answer is ambiguous. And that's what, in many ways, makes this a very terrifying film. The fact that we can be pawns in this game, you know, there's this cosmic game of chess between the force of good and the force of evil, and if God decides to wash our hands of us and the devil decides to make us our business,
yeah, you indeed. Know,
it's quite terrifying. So Thomason goes into the woods, and it is amazing the way this film is shot, because the other little farm, and this was shot in Northern Ontario.
Yes, and near the Quebec border, and very austerely, yeah, it was mm-hmm. just, it was very bleak.
Yeah, and the woods just loom with this ominous presence, and the way it's shot, you get that sense, these wide-angle shots of the woods, and you know, like, there's something evil lurking in there. They're in those woods, and as you mentioned earlier, Thomason is playing a game of peekaboo with little baby brother Samuel. She would shut her eyes, open them, shut her eyes, open them. All of a sudden, like that, he's gone. In a split second, in a flash, baby Samuel is taken.
Yeah, one less mouth to feed. These were tough times. Okay, no. yeah, he's taken off into the woods by a cloaked figure. And this is really, again, going back to the complaints we saw online. It's like, why wasn't there more witch? Why wasn't there more this? Why wasn't there more that? They hint at the witch at the beginning in a way that the movie's really immaterially about the witch. You don't need the witch, really. It's just the presence and the piety of the family mm-hmm. and testing their faith, a la reference to Abraham and Isaac. That that was no detriment at all.
No,
but you get the witch. You
right,
don't need more of
there
the witch. You
got it. Yeah. And right away, you know
the witch count.
You,
yeah.
You know the witch. You see the witch doing something to poor Samuel. We as an audience are afforded the knowledge that the family doesn't have. There's some sort of ritual
sacrifice. Yeah.
There's some bathing in blood.
Yeah, there's like a mortar and pestle, and she's grinding, mm-hmm. I guess, the poor Samuel's baby parts into some concoction. It was almost like a Macbeth, witch's brew that she was back in her lair. That was really evocative, really cool.
And that, I read that as a witch somehow using the youthful vitality of Samuel to then regain her youth.
Yeah, vampiric. Yeah. Again, so yeah, the battle of this family versus the woods, the wilderness, the witch, and their faith. So a three-pronged battle that they're facing.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention just being shunned by the town and the battling one another, because as you said, the wife is begging not only to go back to England, their original homeland where they fled whatever religious strife, and or also the Massachusetts colony that's around the corner that would provide them with a town, an actual town, mm-hmm. so they wouldn't have to live at their, you know, on their own means with this crappy, blighted corn and their inability to get farm anything and mm-hmm. the lack of apple trees that the young Caleb has envisioned. That they can't find anything. They can't harvest anything.
At one point, the father takes Caleb into the woods to go hunting, and they have a dog named Fowler, and Fowler starts going a little crazy because they spot a rabbit. Now, in this movie, evil comes in many, many forms. And many forms you may think are somewhat incongruous for evil. Well, hey, if you see Ernest Borgnine as the devil in The Devil's Reign, then why can't evil be in the form of a rabbit and other animals? And we'll get to that afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, true.
And the father tries to shoot with his musket the rabbit so they could have some, maybe some rabbit stew, some of the, besides their pitiful little repast. And the gun misfires in his face. It's just one calamity after another. And these are small compared to what's going to happen as the film progresses.
Yeah, it's almost like they've been hit by a plague. Is they cannot grow their own food, and then one calamity after another introduces itself. And yeah, we speak to the rabbit, which is a regular presence, but there's also other animals that appear here in the form of what I thought was really terrific is Black Phillip.
Of course, and Black Phillip is the central, I would say, character.
Antagonist? The satanic goat antagonist.
One thing that came out of this movie was sort of like a cult figure in Black Phillip. People who did see this movie, did like this movie, loved
Black Phillip. Almost stole the picture. it was great.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, look, you have this...
The cloven hooves.
You have this cloven-hoofed, horned piece of livestock, colored in black, which, of course, is the color of evil. Mm. And we have these twins, Mercy and Jonas, and we don't know if they're playing or if they really are, but they claim to have the ability to converse with Black Phillip. That Black Phillip says things to them that are evil. Yeah. And Thomason, and in order to sort of get them to shut up, she claims that she's a witch. And they take that at face value. They are now convinced that their sister's a witch. And you know, they're already more or less convinced that something witch-like got their brother Samuel. Beyond that, let's just talk about Thomason. And, I mean, this poor girl. I mean, okay, so this is a girl. How old do you say Thomason was in this movie?
Yeah, probably 12, 13.
Right, because they mentioned her as becoming a woman. Mm-hmm. And
a lot of psychosexual elements.
Stuff between her and her brother.
Yeah.
In many ways, this film examines that too, you know? The sinful nature of a woman just for being a woman. And we sort of discussed this when we talked about Ginger Snaps, is that when you enter into womanhood, birthing womanhood, you are by nature sinful for nothing of your own accord. If you happen to develop a little more than other girls and you have a bigger set of bosoms and men seem to, you know, be attracted to that, you're sinful because you're welcoming these unwanted gazes. You are promoting impure thoughts in other people.
For sure.
And the father is an interesting character because he does, even though he is, and he even says at one point when he's praying to God, he says, you know, I commit the sin of pride. But he's willing to give his children the benefit of the doubt. He's willing to sort of ride things out and see how, you know, and hope. He has hope that things are going to get better. The mother is a naysayer from the very beginning. And she wants Thomason out. She wants Thomason to be given to another family. And she basically intimates that Thomason is not right with Thomason. This blonde, attractive young woman. Now, the father, he's an ineffectual human being because all he can do is pray. He cannot farm. He cannot hunt. So what does he do? He chops wood. And that's a repeated motif again and again and again. He's chopping wood. And why is he doing this? I would say there's for two reasons. Number one, perhaps to get out his aggressions, because he knows that he's not doing his husbandly duties, his fatherly duties, and he has to somehow release his aggressions. And B, yet again, he's got to do something.
It's what they do. It's the Puritan, Protestant work ethic, as exemplified by them. Idle work is the devil's hands. He's busying himself with being busy, because this is all these people do, which is when I get back to the beginning of this, saying, holy crap, of all the time periods in history to focus on, just think of the French Revolution, with like Robespierre and the Jacobins, like the heads were being chopped off every which way. You could have filmed a movie in that period, but no, this is just a devout, quiet, God-fearing family alone in the woods. But
what the fuck did he need all that wood for?
Nothing. No, they weren't going to make it through the winter. Yeah, exactly. they were not going to make it. And he has a little, again, he has a little hunting trip with the son. The son ventures out into the woods himself later on, stealing. Okay, not stealing, because it's technically the family's possession, but an ill-advised foray into the woods, taking the most valuable life-saving asset this family owns, which is the horse, and the musket, goes off on a... What kind of expedition was that? Like,
was he? I think was he looking for Samuel? Was he looking for food?
Who knows what? It's just he's trying to prove he's the man.
He can provide for the family.
Yeah, yes. And Thomason, she's a strong-willed woman, young woman, and she insists that they go out together. And this is the turning point of the movie here, at the halfway point, where they're all ill-suited to doing anything. They cannot fend for themselves either. They're almost like little surrogates of Dad, who can't fend for himself, or the family, who can't fend for themselves. They go off into the woods. The horse is frightened, runs off. Young Caleb, who's been tempted by his burgeoning bosom of his sister earlier, gets tempted by a witch in the forest. He disappears. She's left stranded, and this family has another calamity to face it. Two of their kids are missing in the woods. That's when things ratcheted up at that point.
And we can assume that the witch attempted Caleb, very beautiful, bewitching, that this was the same witch we saw earlier.
Yeah, there's a reason bewitching is a word.
Exactly. She has now become this beautiful woman.
Yeah, she emerges from the cave and just tempts him and actually plants a kiss on this young kid. That was really pretty ballsy to show that.
Yep. She seduces him and then she takes him in every sense of the word because he's missing for a while. And without... I don't want to go
30
through
seconds? No, he is missing for a while. Yeah.
As you said before, everything ratchets up to... that's another thing this film is wonderful. It's the mounting dread. Whatever terror this family's facing, whatever calamity that has befallen them, something's going to get worse. Caleb has returned. He's found naked, sickly.
Shivering, yeah. And they have to... They undergo some bloodletting ritual in the middle of their, I guess, hovel, where they take a knife out, cut him on the temple, let some blood let out of his skull right into a bowl, say the Lord's Prayer. They're trying to muster all their resources,
meanwhile,
such as they are, to try and help this kid who's on death's door.
And Mercy are unable to even utter the prayer. They seem to have forgotten it. So, I mean, shit is happening all around them. Caleb spits out a rotted apple. He dies. He comes back. He's having hallucinations. Now, I read this scene. This is really the last thing I want to go into in great detail because I don't want to spoil much more of it. But he's screaming and he's talking about pain and hellfire and you think that he dies. And my interpretation is that he was rejected from heaven for whatever sins he committed, for the original sin, and then thrown into hell. And then he comes back to life. And then
he's saved.
About the embrace of Jesus.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like God said, you know what? On second thought, I'll accept you. But the family is, I mean, at this point, they're at their wits' end. They don't know what to do anymore. They think that everybody is possessed. The father locks everybody up in the barn with Black Phillip.
Yeah, there's allegations, again, of some bestial impropriety between the twins and the goat. They have some sort of telepathic connection with one another. And, yeah, again, he's left at his wit's end. He's got a daughter who's his wife is calling a witch. He's got two kids who are tempted by the devil.
Well, the kids, I mean, don't forget that Thomason said to the twins, I am a witch.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're repeating that back, and they're starting to believe it. The mother is completely convinced. The mother has something really fucked up that happens to her, which I'm not going to talk about.
Yeah, for
really
sure.
Cool scene. And, yeah, the father is he does not know what to do at this point. He's so beside himself. And there's another very interesting line where the mother has this almost like this soliloquy where she talks about at one point in her life being so happy in God's embrace. She would pray and she would feel the love of God, the love of Jesus, the love. And now when she prays, because this mother just prays throughout the entire movie, she doesn't feel it. And she doesn't think she'll ever get back there again. And then she starts to say for the umpteenth time, I want to go home. And that can be read in two ways. That she wanted to go home, because all the time she's trying to say to her husband, let's go back to where we came from. Please, ask for forgiveness, what have you. He refuses because he says, I'm not going to go back, a beggar. Now, does home represent the physical place, or does home represent home within the bosom of a higher
God,
power,
yeah.
of God? And then more shit happens, and without spoiling the movie,
let's talk
a little bit about
Black the Phillip. Shit that happened? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's three dynamite animal-related scares that are in this. Obviously, like for anyone with any kind of background whatsoever in cursory biblical studies, the goat, the cloven hoof, the devil, that creature is possessed, and it's a great performance by this goat, I gotta say. Its eyes are kind of demonic, the way it looks at the camera. It attacks the father at one point, and which is just really neat. And there's another scene, with speaking of goats, where Thomason is milking one of them, and blood comes out. Yes. And that was really disgusting, but the apogee of animal-related grossness in this thing was, I think, a bona fide, amazing scare, which is the mother nursing. And then the raven
that
comes out.
I didn't want to reveal.
Oh, okay. We're going to reveal it. Only because it starts pecking at her bosom, almost like Prometheus, who was doomed to have his liver pecked by, what was it, crows when he was punished by Zeus? I don't know. But the raven pecking at the eyes in this, well, it was her bosom here, but that's a biblical reference from Proverbs. If you scorn your father and mock your mother, or you got that reversed, I don't know. There's a line in the Bible of pecking the eyes out of a raven, and ravens are interesting figures, and that really, I jumped when I saw that. It was disgusting, and I'm glad it was as brief as it was, because that is something I've never seen before, and you're unlikely to see that ever in years. That was one for the ages of nasty, terrifying fright. I mean, a woman with her, it's breastfeeding is nurturing, and to have her being pecked by some vicious creature, that was, whoa.
The actress that played the mother, this is like her, she's almost getting typecast as a woman in disgusting breastfeeding scenes. This is her second scene of disgusting breastfeeding. Because she plays a character in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
That's seen many a time suckling her 6-7-year-old son.
Ooh, yeah.
So that's yeah, it's this is that's her stock and trade in Hollywood.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was interesting to see also the father, who I didn't even recognize until I read it after. He plays the lecherous salesman on the UK version of The Office. And he was completely obscured.
You're telling me he was a Todd Packer of the UK?
He was. Finchie is the character there. And I don't know what he is in the American version, but.
Oh my God.
In the UK version, well, like when the woman in the office bends over and he'll say stuff, well, you're down there, love, and thrust his crotch in her face. Like he's a lecherous idiot. And I thought, holy crap, that guy, like, that's amazing range. To go from The Office to this, completely unrecognizable. I should have known the voice, but his towering presence was fantastic. The whole cast was very good.
The cast was uniformly strong. The sound design was incredible. That alone, I mean, was enough to create a sense of unease. The composition of the camera, everything about this movie was masterful. The restraint when it needed to be restrained. The going for the gusto when it needed to be. This was a masterclass in how to craft a terrifying movie. Stephen King himself. Now, you know, Stephen King, his opinion sometimes are a little suspect, but he said that when he saw The Witch, he was terrified. Abjectly terrified.
See, that's where I'm going to take the populist point of view here, where I take this film like medicine, where it's good for you, but it's not enjoyable. It goes down, and like I enjoy it as a spectacle, as a piece of art, but I wasn't personally taken, with the exception of two scenes, I wasn't particularly frightened by it. It might be my antipathy towards religious themed horrors. Like, it wasn't frightening to me, but that some people were taking it more as a drama, like some of the online wags who are like, okay, this is, and there's a certain type of online critic who will also say that it has to be idea-driven to be horrific. I don't think that's necessarily the case. This had lots of ideas in it, but I wasn't particularly moved by it. So, other than as a piece of art and a great hurdy-gurdy score of droning music and a couple of really intense scenes of visceral disgust, but it wasn't what I would describe to me as anything that would be horrifying to me, subjectively.
Well, subjectively, this was everything that you say. I basically think the opposite. I think this was absolutely horrifying, and I think it was an absolutely masterful movie. I cannot wait to see Robert Eggers as next, and I can't wait to give you my star rating. But before we do that, what did you learn from The Witch?
Oh, well, I love this stuff where you have you know, pioneering people are trying to make do in the wilderness. And I think had Blumhouse dealt with this, I think there would have been maybe Algonquin ghostly tribesmen out in the woods, or like people shooting bow and arrows, or like some kind of First Nations voodoo magic business in it. And I think that they're wise to steer clear of that and just stick to the family and their inability to succeed there, or in the words of William, conquer the wilderness, which is what they were trying to do unsuccessfully at the beginning, is they weren't ready for New England winters. That was a neat thing to learn. The father just being beside himself at one point, saying when they're faced with the prospect of having no horse, no gun, no crops, and having to figure out how they're going to get to the settlement without these things. They're presumably hundreds of miles from. They wanted to be separated from the rest of the Puritans, so they had to venture in this nasty, unforgiving terrain to get back home. And they would not necessarily be allowed back home either. They were shunned. I don't think the Puritans were very forgiving sort.
Nor would the father even
entertain such a notion, exactly. After he would deem it a personal failure of his faith and his piety, and that struggle between him and his wife was quite interesting. Like,
well,
go home. You're stuck here. You're not going to make it. You know, that's, of course, our modernized seeing that. Like, you guys are fucked. But, yeah. Oh, what did you learn?
Well, you know, in many ways, the setting of the movie was wonderful in the sense that, you know, you had this looming forest that was imbued with dread, and you knew what... But in many ways, I mean, this movie really was a seven-person play. In that, you know, you had the five kids and the patriarch and the matriarch. You had such an economical cast. And this could have been produced for the stage, and with just the right amount of... stage magic, indicating a goat here, and yeah, a crow here, and, you know, a noise here. This would have been a wonderful stage production. In fact, I can still see it becoming a stage production. I'm not quite sure if you said this as we were recording or earlier when we were just talking about this movie off the record, and you mentioned it as medicine.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I appreciate it, but I didn't enjoy it.
Okay.
And that's sort of, but that's not necessarily a debit. Mm-hmm. It's just I don't feel compelled to see it again,
right,
in the same way I was moved by another period piece we talked about earlier, Bone Tomahawk, mm-hmm, which I just thought was so much, right, more charged.
But I think you said something when you said it's like medicine. I think you said that it aspires to be high art, but it doesn't reach that level. I believe it reaches that level. I feel, like you said before, that this could have been like The Crucible or some sort of play of that ilk, but it just happened to be made for the screen. And with it, that's what I learned. I learned that this is a horror movie as art.
Yeah, I guess I would have been more invested in it had there been, because I'm not typically moved by religious themed horror. It's not my thing. But if it's gonna be my thing, I'd rather have. I like the tension between something from another realm, demonic, what have you. The tension between that and modernity, more so than a bunch of God-fearing people who fear the devil anyway. Like, it doesn't affect me as much in that respect. Also, the first 40 minutes, a little bit kind of stagey and a little yakety-yak fest for me. And that's where I agree with some of the web pundits, and there's lots of thous and these. And a major debit at the end, of all things, and they should have removed this entirely, was the silly descriptor about how the dialogue was based on a real-life pioneer pilgrim speech,
yeah,
from 17th century New,
yeah,
England. It's like... Oh, that's irrelevant.
That,
so, yeah,
I, yeah,
a lot of ye,
yeah,
thou, ye's, and you's, and love you the Bible, love you not the prayer, and all this kind of thing, but still, like...
So are you basically saying that you couldn't understand what they were saying? Like,
no, but it's just, it was a little much. Like, a little, but I guess...
But that's a part of the time, so...
Yeah, but you can be given a little bit of artistic license. Like, I didn't feel like any of the characters would individually drawn out too much. Like, they were pretty much... But then, it speaks to what I said earlier. It's like, you're filming a movie set with these people who are not the most well-rounded, interesting people you could imagine. Let's put it that way, right? Mm. And so
I disagree completely.
No, but they all speak the same way. They're all, like, they're limited by who they are. So they're all just penitent, God-fearing, pious folk, and you can only go so far.
I feel
there was not. There was all the same talk over and over again. I'm in sin. No, you're not. We're going to make it. No, we're not. It was that
through
kind of
the direction, through the dialogue, through the acting, what we saw, what we were given, what we heard, we knew so much more about their internal life and their external life and everything that happened in, let's say, the two-year period between when they were banished and when they resell. We knew it all. Every character, in my opinion. The only characters that might have been a little bit not well-rounded were the twins. But I thought Thomasin, wow, I mean, you knew a lot about Thomasin just from the little bit of dialogue she spoke. You knew a lot about William from the decisions he made. And the same with the wife. Just by her constant bawling and crying and praying, you knew all about them. Caleb as well. I think this film rewards multiple viewings, and I think if you see it again, you might change your opinion.
Well, I saw it twice. It's just like I was, like, I don't want to say bored silly by the first time, because I don't think that's a valid criticism to be bored, because you have to come up with a reason why you were bored. You can't just say, I'm bored, and then that's it. So I gave it another chance to see if I could become more involved in it, which I did, but I also felt that they telegraphed the denouement through... Okay, I can't say. Let's not, but I saw that coming, and I was underwhelmed by it. But again, it doesn't matter so much because people in the theater, their reaction was, that's it when this thing happened. But I don't think that was necessarily a fault because they could have gone several ways with it. I saw it coming, and it didn't really bother me that it ended so abruptly, if we can say that, without spoiling it.
It wasn't the destination, though, for me. It was the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And
it wasn't bad. It wasn't a bad ending. Mm-hmm. It was a neat ending, in fact. It just, yeah, I saw it coming. But, again, you can't levy that as a criticism, because some of our favorite horror films, you can see what's coming from a mile away.
Like,
it doesn't negate horror, the fact that you see something coming.
All I can say is that the decisions that Thomasin made at the end of the movie were not the decisions that that Thomasin would have made when we met her at the beginning of the movie, but because of what was foisted upon her by other people in her family, she was forced to make those decisions.
She was no doubt the star. She was so compelling, like her wide-eyed, just innocence, yet subversive, sinfulness as well. Like, she really had to walk that fine line. She was a great character on which the whole thing, revolved.
Thomasin and Black Phillip.
Who would have thought?
That was one kick-ass goat.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm giving my star rating right now, and I'm giving it 4.5 stars.
Oh my god, I'm going to give it a 3.5, because who would have thought, like, you've got to hand it to this guy, and focusing on this family of unnatural providence out in the woods, fending for themselves. Yeah, good on him for all this. And also, like, numerous heavy-duty biblical references that made it a pleasure and a challenge to follow them all. Not some of them were more overt, others more covert, but also to read about the time period, which I thought was fascinating. So this was a learning experience as well.
This film took place in 1602, so this is well before the Salem Witch Trials. This is the beginning of the witch hysteria in the United States. But yeah, I stand by my rating, 4.5 stars. I'm not going to give it 5. It's not perfect. There are, it's just a little debit here. I do agree with you with the descriptor at the end. That was superfluous, vacuous, unneeded, what have you. But otherwise, the film was a pleasure to watch and rewatch and rewatch. And I'm sure I'm going to watch many, many, many more times.
Okay, I can't say the same, but definitely check out our website many, many times. www.reallyawfulmovies.com. And follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.